there is a relationship between what you love and what you're good at, because love leads to appetite, appetite leads to practice, practice leads to performance.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. Back with episode number 193 of Future Proof. Bill Sheridan here. Great as always to have you with us. We got another fantastic conversation for you this week, and we're going to get to it here in just a minute. First, though, a reminder that this week's show, actually every week's show, is made possible by our preferred providers. And we actually like to think of these folks as partners. These are the organizations, the relationships, the partnerships that allow us, the MACPA, to do a lot of the great stuff that we do for our profession, including this podcast. But these partners, they do way more than that. They're doing things that we believe can help you all become a little bit more future ready and thrive in this ever-changing world. And help really is the key word here. They truly, truly do want to help. So please reach out to them, find out more about what they can do and how they can help you, because they can, folks. You'll find out more about all of our preferred providers on our website. That's at macpa.org/showcase. Okay, so this week's show, I want to talk a little bit about engagement this week. Pretty important topic, engagement. You've heard the stats, right? Fewer than one third of American employees are engaged in their work. That's according to 2023 numbers from Gallup. And nearly one in five workers are what Gallup calls actively disengaged, which means bosses, they hate you and they're plotting against you. And I'm only sort of exaggerating there. Here's the thing. Study after study shows that employee engagement directly linked to business performance. The folks at Business Leadership Today, they say that engagement affects profitability, productivity, absenteeism, retention, and customer satisfaction. And it's also linked to a company's ability to innovate and adapt more easily in times of change, which impacts its future performance, end quote. So a lot going on there with engagement. The data also indicates that engagement is closely linked to whether an employee is encouraged to focus on his or her strengths, those things that they're naturally good at, right? Specifically, when your job focuses on your strengths, you're six times more likely to be engaged on the job. And if you're one of the lucky few out there who has a manager who focuses on your strengths, you've got only a 1% chance of being actively disengaged at work, much more likely to be engaged, right? And if your manager focuses on your weaknesses instead, that number jumps to 22%. So, I mean, huge impact engagement has on not just business productivity, but also your personal well-being at work. So, you know, plenty of evidence out there that strengths-based work works, for lack of a better word. And yet, something about all this bugs me, really bugs me. And I think it boils down to this. It's that focus on strengths alone, right? It's not enough to be good at something. We all spend way too much time at work doing things that we don't like to do simply because we've gotten really good at doing them, right? In fact, that's where most of us go to die, isn't it? It's that space where we're doing work that we're good at, but that we hate doing. And there's not a whole lot of engagement in that space, is there? I'm not feeling it when I'm doing that kind of work, and I'm sure you're not either. So that means the secret sauce for engagement, it's part strengths, sure, but it's equal parts love, for lack of a better word, passion, stuff that we really enjoy doing, not just that we're good at doing, right? That's just as important, if not more so, than being good at something. Marcus Buckingham has some questions to ask yourself about all this. Buckingham is one of the world's leading researchers on strengths and human performance. He began his career at Gallup and was the co-creator of StrengthsFinder, which is one of the top strengths assessments out there. He's also the author or co-author of 10 New York Times bestsellers, including his most recent book, which is called Love and Work. And it was in that book where he put forth these questions, right? 10 questions, the answers to which should give you some idea of where you truly enjoy spending your time. Okay, ready? Here they are. 10 questions. When was the last time you lost track of time? When you instinctively volunteered for something? When someone had to tear you away from what you were doing? When you felt completely in control of what you were doing? When you surprised yourself by how well you did, or when you were singled out for praise, when you were the only person to notice something, or when you found yourself actively looking forward to work. Think about that. When was the last time you came up with a new way of doing things, or when you wanted the activity to never end? It's kind of rare, but we've all been in those spaces before, right? And the answers to those questions are what Buckingham calls red threads, right? Things that you love to do, that you're passionate about, that put you in the zone, really, when it comes to work. And once you figure out what those things are, the idea is to weave them through as many of your daily activities as possible. That will ensure that you're doing things that you love to do and are great at doing at various points throughout your day, and building your engagement at the same time. And in fact, Marcus Buckingham is here with me as my guest this week. So I'm really happy to have him with us this week. One of the world's leading experts on strengths and productivity. He sat down with me recently to talk about how we can put these concepts to use in our daily work and lives, how we can kind of reconcile all of this with the fact that we all have to do plenty of stuff that we're not passionate about, and how all of this impacts our search for top talent as well. So great talk this week with a true thought leader in the areas of strengths-based work and productivity, and more to the point, finding those red threads, right? Those things that we love to do and are passionate about doing, because they're going to drive us to higher engagement going forward. Here is my conversation this week with Marcus Buckingham. So Marcus, yeah, like I said, thanks so much for joining me. I heard you speak at Digital CPA in Austin, and I immediately went out and bought a copy of your latest book, Love and Work. Really inspiring stuff, by the way. And I wanted to start by talking about, it's a concept that you brought up early on in the book, and I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. Weird, is that right? W-Y-R-D.
Yeah.
And this ties into a few things that we've been kind of focusing on when it comes to the future of our profession. So I guess, first off, define that term for me, weird. What does that mean?
Well, it's actually an ancient Norse term, and it's spelled W-Y-R-D. It's not an adjective. It's not like you're weird. It's you have a weird. And it's the concept that every human, from the moment they're born, has a distinct spirit, or daimon, the Greeks used to call it, D-A-I-M-O-N, an essence that is within you from the moment you're born. And you can grow and develop, of course you can, but there's something unique in you that is quintessentially you. Today, of course, we know that it's a function of the clash of the chromosomes, and that everybody's got a unique synaptic network in their brains that causes patterns of thought and feeling and behavior that makes people unique. We know there's a biological underpinning to human uniqueness, but back 2000 years ago, 1000 years ago, the Norse bumped into what every parent bumps into, that when their first kid is born, it seems as though there was a personality already in there. And then when the second kid is born to the same parents, it's a different set of personality traits. And it was their attempt to kind of go, what is it about that particular human that makes them that human? And so they landed on this idea that every human has a weird, and that you better come to know yours, because if you don't know yours, if you don't have a relationship to yours, then the world will try to dictate who yours is. And so it was a way kind of owning the uniqueness of you.
That's really interesting. And so talk a little bit about how that ties into this concept of work, right? I mean, what is it about our relationship with our jobs that makes this a conversation worth having?
Well, every single industry, like yours, wants to attract the best people. You want to deserve the best people, which means you've got to try to design work that is interesting and compelling to people, so that it can be a place in which they encounter their best selves and express their best selves, as opposed to something they just put up with, and then they get quote-unquote compensation for putting up with, a really rotten way to spend 40 hours a week or more. So the way that weird fits into this is, and no one ever really tells us this, but the truth of the matter is that every single activity in life that we bump into during the course of a day has energy in it. every single activity is energetic. Some people get a kick out of balancing the book. Some people get a kick out of challenging a client to a new way of thinking. Some people get a kick out of moving people to a course of action they didn't intend to do. There's all sorts of thousands of activities that happen during the course of a day. And every one of those activities has some sort of positive or negative energy within it. I liken them to threads, that every day is like a fabric and you got thousands of threads, and some of them are emotionally sort of neutral. You just have to get through it. They're black, they're white, they're gray, they're green. But some of the threads in a day are red. These are activities that when you're doing them, time flies by. When you're done with them, you kind of want to do them again. Before you do them, you sort of look forward to them. These are red threads. And what we find is that the most effective, successful people in any job, figure out what those particular red threads are. You don't need 100% of them. You need about 20% red threads, but every day. And your weird is that uniqueness, which causes you to find some things like, or see some things as red threads, as compared to other people who seem to not find love in those activities. Mm-hmm. So weird is a way to go, gosh, what are the particular activities in the job that you're doing that you love? We know the most effective people take those loves really seriously. They try to figure out what those red threads are and figure out how to make sure every day has some of them. When you do that, you seem to perform better. You're more creative, more innovative, more resilient. And so as you think about the profession, the accounting profession, let's say, the real challenge for every accountant would be, how can you know yourself well enough to know which bits of accounting, which activities in a day are the things that you love? Mm-hmm. And so all of the stuff that I've written about in Love and Work is about that. How do we do that? Because clearly it's doable. It's just that we don't very often do it intentionally.
It's not necessarily, and you hear this all the time, finding a job or finding work that you love, but finding the parts of the work that you love that's going to sustain you and keep you going. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we often hear that, don't we? Find a job you love and you'll never have to work a day in your life again. And then all of us realize, well, wait a minute. Like, A, I don't know what I love. B, I don't imagine I could ever find a job that perfectly fit what I love. So the whole thing starts to feel incredibly intimidating. Find a job you love and you'll never have to work a day in your life again. It's just too much. So actually, when you study, and this is what I've done for my entire career, I'm now run the ADP Research Institute, where we continue to study real work all the time. And you study highly effective people in any job, and they don't love all that they do. There's no data on that at all. But they do find the love in what they do, which is different. You find the love in what you do. And that means, as you just said, you're finding activities in the job itself that for no good reason other than the fact that you have a weird that is weird. Yeah, it's not like because you're a white male or because you're 47 years old or because you were raised on the East Coast versus the West Coast. It's none of that. It's just the uniqueness of you. You find certain activities invigorating and other ones depleting. And so if you want to excel in a job, any job, you have to be intentional in finding the activities that you love in the job. And no one's going to tell you how to do that. And job descriptions of what, let's say, a CPA has to do. Well, I'm sorry that you could define a CPA through a list of common activities or responsibilities. But you look at 10 great CPAs and they will, I promise you, because we've done it, they will find different activities that they love, even though they're doing the same job. Mm-hmm. And the best ones will have taken that love really seriously. And not like 100%. They don't need 100% of activities they love. But every day they're thinking, in a sense, what red threads can I find today so that I can actually be super productive today and be nourished while I'm doing it? Yeah. And that sounds a bit woo-woo, but you look at the data and it's not woo-woo. It's what the most effective people do.
Well, it's so weird that, yeah, we spend a lot of time working with folks who we come in contact with about around this concept of time management, right? And how they are spending their time versus how they should be spending their time. And it's really kind of an exercise in delegation when we come right down to it. It's like, what should you be spending more time doing and maybe perhaps delegating away other stuff? And we often coach them by saying, look, your organizations need you to spend as much of your time as possible on two things, right? A, the things that you love to do, and B, the things that you're really, really good at doing. And the more time you can spend on those things, and the more of the other things that you can delegate away, the better off you're going to be personally, but the better off your organization is going to be as well. It's really kind of your sweet spot. And it sounds like, I don't know, weird sounds very related to that concept, maybe a little bit different, but I think they're running parallel there.
Yeah. I mean, the whole point of the weird thing is that no one ever tells you this in school. No one really ever tells you this in college. And very, very few, other than a few good managers, perhaps tell you this in the world of work. But activities themselves are energetic. There is energy in every single activity that you do in the course of a working day. And some of that energy is positive and some of it is negative. And every one of us are different in terms of which activities really lift us up and which activities deplete us. It's not as though, oh, everybody hates that bit of the job. That's not true. Like you talk to me about balancing books and I'll lean away. But the person who was the CFO for my company, I would walk by, you know, every other day and I would see him just shiver with joy at the fact that something worked out on a particular balance sheet that he was looking at. And it wasn't fake. It wasn't like, it was like, he loved that. Now, there is a relationship between what you love and what you're good at, because love leads to appetite. Appetite leads to practice. Practice leads to performance. Mm-hmm. It isn't a perfect correlate of one. So as you know, sometimes you're really good at things you hate. Mm-hmm. By the way, weirdly, we often call those strengths, and that's kind of weird. The proper definition of a strength actually is an activity that strengthens you, and a weakness is an activity that weakens you, even if you're good at it. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes, because of the crazy complexity of the world, you will find yourself really, really, really good at something that you never want to do again.
Well, it's kind of that seventh layer of hell, right? It's where we spend a whole lot of our time doing stuff that we don't like doing, but we've just gotten good at it over time, you know?
Right. And some of that we have to do. I mean, this research out of the Mayo Clinic that I quoted in the book, they were looking at burnout in doctors and nurses. This was pre-pandemic, actually. They had an epidemic of burnout in doctors and nurses pre-pandemic. And they studied, rightly, the ones who didn't burn up, the doctors and nurses that were somehow nourished by what they were doing. And they tried to figure out what it was and what was the secret. And they found a whole bunch of things. But one of the things was that they had 20% of their activities that they loved every day. Every day. It wasn't like once a month you sort of save it all up and you do one day of love out of the 28 or whatever. It's every day you're thinking, what are the things that nourish me? What are the things I look forward to? What are the things where time flies by? And then they are sort of diligent, as you said, in their time management. Or indeed, sometimes it's just your attention management, that you're deliberately attending to the things in your day that you love, the red threads that you love. And that action of taking control of your job and deliberately tilting it, not 100%, but tilting it so that every day you're thinking about, what are the things that I do today that for no good reason other than my weird, nourish me? And it's strange because that's not something that we're taught how to do. And yet clearly it's something that correlates very tightly toward not just top performance, but sustainable top performance. It's a very unique skill set to do that in your own life. And that's why I wrote the book. And that's why I was so passionate in talking about it with the folks in Austin.
Yeah. And from a leadership or management point of view, I mean, let's talk about that for a second. So one of the big issues in our profession, if not the biggest, I mean, we hear people talk about this all the time, is recruitment and retention, right? Finding and keeping really great talent. And it's something that everyone's struggling with for a number of different reasons, but it sounds like there's a tie-in here from a leadership point of view. How should this concept of weird kind of tie in to the task of finding and keeping really talented people?
Well, we're going into, regardless of whether we hit a recession or some sort of mild recession this year, the overall demographics, particularly of the US, are that we're going to have tighter and tighter labor markets over the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so every profession has got to figure out, what's our talent brand? Every company's got to figure out, what's our talent brand? And really what that means is, why would anyone really, really good want to come work for me? And what are we putting out there on the Indeeds or the LinkedIns or whatever you use to recruit your people? What words are we using when we advertise for jobs? What words are we using when we put job descriptions out there? What are we telling the outside world about what will happen to them when they come work for us? And one of the messages that the best companies are going to use in their talent brand, and you'll see this happening in terms of, you know, future focus and stuff and future proofing your company, I'm going to bet my bottom dollar what you'll see is that the best companies will start going, listen, you come work here and we will be super curious about the unique fingerprint that you make on the world and how you can actually turn that into contribution here in our company. We're not going to promise you every single perk and every single benefit. We're not going to promise you the world because everyone does that. Instead, we're going to go, we are super interested in you, what's unique about you and how you can turn it into contribution for our clients. We are going to take the individuality of you seriously. And for the generation just coming into the workforce, there is nothing better. That messaging super resonates with them. You don't overpromise. All you do is you go, we are interested in who you uniquely are. And you come to work here. And we're not saying it's going to be, you know, motherhood and apple pie and perfection every single day. We're going to have to make a contribution to our clients. And that's not always straightforward, but we're always going to start with you. Well, if your talent brand is based upon deep curiosity about you, and everything we talk about is our managers are going to try to figure out where you're at your best. We're going to try to figure out how you can learn and develop skills which amplify you at your best. Anything like that that's focused on turning someone's unique loves into contribution, and that's what work is for. Okay, that is going to be right in line with all of these Gen Zs that are graduating out of universities going, which I don't know that I want to go work for a company where I am some sort of anonymous human resource. And that's a lot of what you're seeing in the world of work today where people going, I don't know that work should be a place that alienates me from me.
That's
so
right.
So if certain companies are able to push against that and go, no, we're not going to alienate you from you. We're going to be actually really interested in you. Now, that doesn't mean we're not going to be demanding and challenging. And we will be, just like any great sports coach would be. But any great sports coach will always start with, we're going to look at you, the recruit. Where are you most gifted? And we're going to try to build teams where each person on the team has found their spot. Any talent brand like that will be super compelling.
And it's funny. I hear that. Like I interviewed Tom Peters not too long ago, and he called it, what did he call it? Extreme humanism.
Yeah.
Was his phrase for it. He said the era that we find ourselves in now is like, it's one of the keys to leadership and management now is this idea of extreme humanism, of being hyper-focused on your people and what drives them. And the ones who succeed at that are going to succeed, period. You know?
Yes. I mean, we've lived in a world, I think Tom's exactly right. I think he's been right ever since In Search of Excellence. He's got a thread through there that is extremely humanistic. And what that means to me when I hear Tom talk and the books that he's written, he's really pushing on the idea, and it's a moral idea, that the fundamental ultimate morality is that each human has worth and each human's development of growth is worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And we are not just amoral elements of a transaction where you sell your time and your talent and you get money for selling it. That's often how we think of, quote, human resources. You're just a resource. You're an element of an equation. And we try to maximize you. And when the business does a downturn, we just lay you off. And of course, sometimes that in capitalism, that does happen. But it's weird. The way in which that sort of thing happens these days is very amoral. It's like, hey, it's 12 o'clock. Everyone meet in the main conference room and you got to get your things out by 5. Mm-hmm. And then we'll escort you out. Mm-hmm. Even the way we do layoffs is treating you in a non-humanist way. So Tom, I think, is right. I think the data would support him hugely. Those companies that go, no, the fundamental moral principle of doing anything is that the humans doing it are the point. Mm-hmm. And yes, they've got to turn that into contribution for our clients. And yes, they've got to take their loves and turn them into contribution. This isn't individualism. But those companies that go, you as a human matter, and we're going to have our talent brand based on that, will be ones that will stand out. They will be attractive to the best people, even if you don't perfectly execute against it. That doesn't seem to matter. It's whether the intention is we're interested in you, and you as a unique human have worth just because you're a unique human. And we're going to try to build a company around that that services our clients. And by the way, who you are on the inside is who you are on the outside. Mm-hmm. So if you don't get this right with your people, your clients will feel it. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they feel it immediately, over time, you can tell as a client. Because I had a bunch of financial advisors in the company that I built. We had a bunch of external financial resources that we lent into. And you could tell those firms that burned their people up, and you kind of didn't want to be around them, even if they did good work.
Right.
You kind of didn't want your own company infected by that kind of amorality. I'm not saying immorality, but amorality.
Right. And it's that notion of you take care of your people and your people will take care of your clients, right?
And you can pick it up in the air. It's like an energy field almost. If you've got a whole bunch of people working, I mean, I had 100 people working in my company. We're a $100 million company, and you have people outside of you that you lean into to support everything that you're doing financially, in terms of tax, in terms of audit, and so on. And if you got a feeling, and we did a couple of times, that there was a firm out there that was really, they did good work, but they were, I hesitate to use the word exploitative. Mm-hmm. But they were depleting the living daylights out of their people. And what you don't want as a client, you don't want that around your own people. It's an energy field that you want to keep away. Yes. So on some level, it's just purely transactional. If you treat your people well, then they'll treat the clients well. And on some level, it's energetic. You kind of don't want that to be in the ether of your own company, because you're trying to do good things with your own people. I'm sure every company wants that.
Yep. Well, so here's another wrinkle to this whole conversation, right? And with this profession, accounting and finance, we're kind of at an inflection point here. And we're not the only profession that's dealing with this. We've got new technologies that are starting to automate a lot of the data-driven tasks that we've done for generations. And what we're finding is that in order to stay relevant going forward, we're going to have to focus on learning some new skills. And we think there are things like strategic and critical thinking, leadership, communication and storytelling of all things, things that we weren't necessarily taught when we were studying to become CPAs have now become really, really important that we learn them going forward. So I'm kind of curious how we should be approaching this directive to learn new skills in a way that also incorporates this idea of, weaving these red threads of things that we love to do, staying true to our own weird, right? How does this notion of kind of future focused education play into all this?
Well, first of all, we're going to go down the path of AI. We're going to go down the path of machine learning. There's no question we're going to do more and more of that. Even that most recent ChatGPT thing, you can sort of see how AI can help you even write and create articles and so on. What's interesting, though, about all of it, frankly, I'm not scared at all about us being sort of out of work because the robots have taken our jobs, because what we're trying to do basically is add machine learning or machines to tasks that humans can't do as well as machines. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a lot of those tasks. But there's an awful lot of tasks and activities in a job that machines will never do as well as humans do. You've mentioned some of them there. So how you play out contingency plans and what if scenarios, how you give clients meaning through story, through example, through vignette, how you make a client feel heard, how you make a client feel as though you understand the uniqueness of their particular situation. Leadership, as you said, like building confidence in others so that they follow you into the future. All of these things are a function of how authentic we think the other person is being as a human. Mm-hmm. We don't trust machines. We want somebody, I mean, if you think about it, the most basic thing that we want as customers of CPAs, we want agency as customers. We want to know where we stand. We want you to help us know where we stand. We want to know what to do next. We want to have some place to go ask questions because we know at some point we're going to get lost. But the first most basic customer need is agency. Mm-hmm. Don't give me disorientation. I don't want to be disoriented. I want to feel as though I've got some sort of efficacy in my financial world and you're helping me. Well, machines can do the most basic level of that. All of the stuff that helps me feel like you've heard my questions, you've heard my challenges, you've played out some of those contingency plans, you've actually were there for me in the right emotional way when I needed you to be. All those things are deeply human. And there are things that customers really, really want and will never get from the chatbots or whatever else machine learning things that we manage to do for people. Right. So as we think about skill development, the best way to think about it, to my view, would be, let's think about what customers really want. What would a loving, this is going to sound silly, I realize, but what would a loving experience be for a customer of a CPA or a CPA firm? Mm-hmm. If you loved someone, what would you do for them? Well, there's a few things you'd clearly do. You would give them agency. You would be emotionally coherent. So if they were worried, you would know they were worried and you would meet them where they were in terms of the fact that they were concerned about this or this. You would help them be seen as an individual. You would help them feel, who do they need to be connected with? That's the warmth of others. You'd figure out how to help that client know that there are other clients like them, perhaps, who might be able to support them. You would definitely help them know about their better future. If you loved someone, you know that love is a forward-facing emotion. You would help them think about what's next. Where do we go next? So if you think about, if you loved someone, what kind of experience would you give them? You don't bump into 1,000 different words. You bump into a few key things like agency, seen as an individual, warmth, better future, those kinds of things. Well, if you thought about the customer like that, then you would back into the skills that you needed the CPAs to have to meet those needs, to create those sort of experiences. Because that's, in the end, that's the future for CPAs. You're not doing tasks. You're creating experiences for customers or clients. And if you want to stand out, you will create an authentic, meaningful, loving experience for that client. Yes, you'll do the audit work. Yes, you'll do the tax work. Yes, you'll do the specific things that need to be done. But you'll do it in a way that's experiential. That client will feel, emphasis on the word feel, something about you and your firm that gives them nourishment, confidence to move forward together with you. Mm-hmm. And more and more and more, I'm sorry, if CPA firms don't come to grips with, and this is going to sound weird, but come to grips with feelings that you're creating in your clients, then to your point, you won't know what skills to teach your people. And you'll end up being homogenized with every other CPA firm. You won't be able to stand out. And at that point, you might well be replaced by machines and automation.
Exactly. Oh my gosh. That's a fantastic way of looking at it, Marcus, and one I haven't heard before. So yeah, thank you for that perspective.
My pleasure.
Last question. You think about this a ton. What does the future of work look like to you? I mean, where do you think we're all headed?
Well, you know, it's a super interesting question right now, because you can see, as I mentioned in Austin with the Digital CPA conference, you could see two strains of thought. I mean, some people have come out of the pandemic and gone, work is terrible. Work is just a necessary evil. And I'm just going to put in my time and it's not my family. I'm not going to give the 50, 60, 70 hours a week. I'm going to just, whatever it was, quiet quitting. I'm going to do the minimum. Because you companies, you've shown that you actually don't really care about me at all. But then there is this other strand of people where you can see that they're saying, no, actually work isn't, it's not work-life balance. I mean, that's silly. Work is a part of life. It's a big part of life. Mm-hmm. And it can be an incredibly energizing part of life. And so I see for companies, the future of work is, I mean, I noticed the president of Finland yesterday or the day before yesterday said, look, if we're going to do a 4-day work week, why wouldn't we do 6 hours versus 8 hours? Because if work is bad, which it is, then we should have less of it And so 6 hours, let's do a 24-hour week. And the president of Finland is going to introduce legislation in Finland. And the only reason to bring up Finland is because they'd often lead where Scandinavia goes. Where Scandinavia goes, a lot of the rest of Europe goes. Mm-hmm. And the whole premise there is that work is not a place that enables you to flourish. It's a place that you have to put up with. I tilt very hard against that. I think the best companies are going to be ones that go, listen, work is a place in which you get to actually move through your week, move through your month, your year, in a way that is allowing you to express yourself and to learn something about yourself as you express yourself. And the constancy of work, therefore, doesn't have to be depleting. It can be something in which you feel bigger after you finish at the end of the week, not smaller. Now, we can certainly design really, really boring jobs that deplete people, but we don't have to. Right. And the best companies, and certainly the best CPA companies, will be thinking about how do we make this work invigorating for people, challenging for people, but invigorating based on the premise, A, that people are the fundamental moral point of all this anyway. Mm-hmm. You don't get people work done through people. You get people done through work, which is a mind flip. But then saying, the actual work itself, we ought to be really curious, team by team, person by person, about how this work hits you and which bits of it you might love and lean into. If we can start thinking about work like that as a place in which a person can have a chance to express something about them that's unique and powerful, and consistently talk about that, not as a one and done, but as a work in progress that happens over time. Work can be a place in which we actually encounter ourselves. And the best CPA firms, I think, will take this really, really seriously and think at the 2-foot level, what kind of people are we bringing on? To your question before, what kind of skills are we trying to teach them? What do we say this job is all about? Mm-hmm. And how does it turn into contribution for our clients? Let's talk about it in those terms, because if we do that, the best people will want to come work for us. And we'll leave all those other people to go work for those other companies that think that work is rotten for humans. Okay, then you guys do that over there. Over here, we're going to start making the big step in thinking that work actually can be loving. The work itself can be loving of you. And it can help you step into yourself, encounter yourself in ways that perhaps you can't do with your family or in your community or with your faith or with your hobbies, all of which are jolly good.
Right.
But when work's really good, work can be an amazing place for you to express yourself. I don't mean to be too idealistic, but I think in a tight labor market, those companies that figure out that's the future of work, or at least that can be the future of work.
That's a worthy destination right there. Listen, Marcus, thank you so much for sharing that with me, your insights, your time, much appreciated. And let's continue the conversation. I think this Absolutely. Is a worthy one to have. So thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Terrific thoughts there from Marcus Buckingham, bestselling author and one of the world's leading researchers on strengths and human performance. Be sure to visit loveandwork.org to learn more about Marcus's latest book and the research behind it. And don't forget, this week's show is made possible by our preferred providers, our partners in this profession. They're doing things that we think can help you all become more future ready and thrive in this ever-changing world. And you'll find out more about all of our preferred providers on our website at macpa.org/showcase. And that's the show, gang. Thanks for being here. Have a great week. Talk to you again soon.